Hey, Leah. I did a piece a few years back on the surprising dependence Panama had on its shipping industry. What does this do to a country like that? She flipped through some sheets. They're the only country with more ships than Greece, she said. It's got to bankrupt them. The mention of Greece made Buck check his watch. Late afternoon there, he said. If the plan is working, they ought to be ready to move in when it gets dark. Why are they waiting? Buck shrugged. Mac thinks it gives them an advantage. He doesn't know what's going to unfold, but if they have to shoot their way out or try to escape somehow, he figures they're a leg up in the darkness. Leah sat staring as if she wasn't listening. Something on your mind? Buck said. I was expecting a call or an email by now. Chloe told me a businessman had something he wanted to ship to Petra. Cheap housing modules of some kind. Yeah? Wealthy guy made a killing in low-cost housing, then became a believer. He's really into the timing. Totally buys into Zion's charts and graphs, figures the glorious appearing exactly 7 years from the original agreement between Carpathia and Israel. Don't you? Sure. If Zion told me today was yesterday, I'd believe it. It was clear she had lost her train of thought. I miss him, Buck. I pray for him constantly. We all do. Not like I do. Yeah, I know. What? I know. You do? Course, Buck said. Just thinking about him makes you forget what you were talking about. She looked embarrassed. That's not true. Prove it. We were, talking about ships, Panama and Greece. We were on to modular housing, Leah.
We were, weren't we?
We were. Now, who is this guy, and what do we need to hear from him? Leah stood and looked out a pinhole in the black paint that covered the windows.
Not sure, she said. He's from right here in Illinois, Something Grove. Says we've got less than 3.5 years left, and he'd like us to help him figure a way to get his inventory to Petra. Says they could build the houses themselves in no time. You think he survived, don't you, Buck?
Survived what?
The bombing.
This guy was in Petra?
Zion.
Oh, pardon me. We're back to him. Well, I'm just as concerned about my father-in-law and Chaim and Abdullah, but yes, I do.
Do what?
Think they survived.
We won't be able to tell from the news, will we?
No, but Chang should know. He knows all. Chang had skipped lunch, so when his day was over, he went back to his quarters by way of the central mess and filled a bag with food. There was so much he wanted to listen to, but top priority was tracking his sister. He didn't know if his parents were on the move or already in hiding, but they would be vulnerable regardless without the mark of loyalty. He had sent them contact information on an underground church in their province, but he had never heard back whether they had or would try to make a connection. How would Ming find them if he didn't even know where they were? And how long would it take her to get to China, heading east out of the United North American states? The mood was somber in the palace complex. Everyone seemed in a hurry to get to their quarters. It had been a strange day. Who hadn't seen the attack on the rebels, and was anyone snowed by the so-called technical difficulties that suddenly swept the coverage from the air just when the pilot clearly said he thought he saw people alive below? Chang casually glanced up and down the corridor, quickly entered his quarters, and locked the door. He ran his computer through a quick program that checked his room for bugs. It showed his systems, installed by David Hasid and left for his use and safekeeping, still secure and running normally. Chang wolfed down fruit and crackers, then checked his email. There was his confirmation, addressed to the bogus name he used as an operative of the Global Community Aviation Administration. Passenger GC Peacekeeper Chang Chow from Sector 30, riding with pilot Lionel Whalum, Long Grove, Illinois. Flight plan, non-stop to Pawleys Island, South Carolina. Round trip for Whalum. Mr. Chow's papers in order, destination San Diego, California. Note,
Whalum did not bear the mark of loyalty, but Mr. Chow asserted that he would see to it when they arrived in South Carolina. Chang fired off a thanks, then searched the database for flights from Pawleys Island to San Diego. A flyer scheduled for that route the next day rang a bell in Chang's mind. It was a co-op pilot. So Ming was using co-op people to get herself to China. Was Whalum co-op too? He ran a search against Chloe's records. Nothing. If he was co-op, he hadn't been used yet, or at least she hadn't logged him. Maybe he used another name, or maybe Chloe was behind in entering her records. Chang checked the International GC database, and while the search engine looked for Whalum, he finished eating. He came back to the computer to find a photo of and an entire page on Lionel Whalum of Long Grove, Illinois. The man was black, of African descent. He and his wife and three kids had moved from Chicago to the suburbs when his business became successful. He had won many civic and business awards. His loyalty to the global community was listed as unknown but not suspicious. Chang switched to another database and copied information for a Loyalty Oath Administration Center at Statesville in Illinois. Switching back to Whalum's records, he changed the loyalty designation to Confirmed, documented by the GC Squadron in Statesville on the date Whalum had received his mark. If he was co-op, that would take the heat off, and it ought to tip off Ming that Chang was watching out for her. A tone sounded on Chang's computer, and scrolling type informed him and all other GC personnel of the unfortunate loss of both pilots involved in the attack on rebel forces today. Due to pilot error, their payloads missed the target by more than a mile, and the insurgents fired missiles that destroyed both planes. The global community expresses its sympathy to the families of these heroes and martyrs to the cause of world peace. Chang quickly flipped to the hangar manifests and found that both multi-million NIC aircraft were back and accounted for. The morgue listed both pilots as deceased, remains delivered from crash sites in the Negev. Their personnel records had already been flagged in red with the date of their deaths. He called up the recording from Akbar's office around the time the first flyer would have returned. There was clear conversation with Akbar's secretary and the pilot being escorted to the conference room. A few minutes later came the pleasantries, the invite to sit again. Then Sue Hale.
"Good effort out there today, man."
"Thank you, sir," came the answer with a British accent. "Perfect execution. Felt good."
"I'm sorry. You're unaware then that your mission failed?"
"Sir?"
"That the outcome was negative?"
"I don't follow, Director.
Both incendiaries were bullseyes, and the entire area was consumed as ordered. When I turned from home, the missile had been launched, and according to what I heard..." "You seriously don't know that you missed your target?"
"Sir, if the coordinates were correct, we did not miss."
"There were no casualties, young man."
"Impossible. I saw people there before we launched, and I saw nothing but fire for several minutes before I left."
"The effort was there, as I said. Unfortunately, human error resulted in utter failure."
I'm at a loss, sir."
"You will be demoted, and the party line is that you don't know how such a significant oversight could have occurred."
"Begging your pardon, sir, but I am not convinced it occurred."
"I'm telling you it occurred, and that is what you will tell anyone who wants to know."
"I will not. Either you prove to me we missed our target, or I will maintain to everyone I know that this mission went off without a hitch."
"You will see in due time reconnaissance photos that show no loss of life in Petra."
"You've seen these?"
"Of course I have."
"And you have no doubt as to their veracity?"
"None, son."
There was a long pause. The young man's voice sounded pitiful. "If there is one survivor on that mountain, it's a miracle. You know what we dropped there. You ordered it yourself. It can't be explained away, and I won't take the heat for it."
"You already have. You and your compatriot will be reassigned, and you know how to respond to..."
"I will not testify to something I don't believe, sir."
Come, come, mister. I see the two on your hand and the image of our leader. You're a loyal citizen. You contribute to the cause. You...
Would the potentate want me to say I made a mistake when I didn't?
But you did.
I did not.
His Excellency is most disappointed in you, son.
I'm not doing it, Director Akbar.
Excuse me?
I won't play along. I take great pride in my work.
I didn't question the order. I believed these people were dangerous and a threat to the global community. I did what I was instructed to do, and I did it right. No one can tell me we missed the primary target, or that our 82s didn't waste that whole area and all those people. If you have evidence that proves concretely that they survived, then I'm going to call it what it is. I'll accept no demotion, and I won't parrot a party line. If those people are still alive, they're superior to us. If they are still alive, they win. We can't compete with that.
You realize you leave me no choice.
Sir?
We cannot have personnel shirk responsibility for their own errors.
You will not be able to silence me.
Akbar laughed and was interrupted by the intercom. Primary pilot is waiting, sir. Send him in.
As soon as Chang heard the sound of the door, the Brit started in.
Tell him, Yuri. Tell him we didn't screw up.
What?
And the conversation began anew. Akbar blaming the failure on the pilots, the Brit protesting, Yuri silent for the moment.
Excuse me a moment, gentlemen, Suhail said.
The door opened and closed.
Kerry, Yuri said, listen to me. He's right.
He's not right.
I saw what I saw, and I will never...
Shh! Listen!
You and I both know we launched perfectly. But I was there after you had gone. You heard my transmission. Those people survived the Blues and the Lance, lived through it all.
Impossible!
Impossible, but true.
A miracle!
Obviously.
Then we must live with it, Yuri. We must make the GC and the world face it.
They are a more than formidable enemy, and unless we admit that, we'll never have a chance to defeat them.
I agree. You heard me try to say it.
They took you off the air. Now they want to make us the scapegoats, demote us, make us admit failure.
Not me, Yuri said.
That's my man, the Brit said.
They traded encouragement.
Be strong. Don't give in. Let's stick together.
Chang checked Akbar's phone. Suhail had called the medical wing and asked for Dr. Consuelo Conchita. Only the day before, Chang had read the staff bulletin announcing her promotion to Surgeon General of the Global Community.
Connie, Akbar said. I need 2 heavy doses of sedative, the quick stuff. My conference room, ASAP. I'll have security here in case the patients resist, and bring gurneys from the morgue.
The morgue?
I want them cremated.
You're asking for lethal doses?
No. I just want them out before they leave here, under sheets. The cremation will do the rest, will it not?
Kill them? Of course it will. You're asking that we execute 2 people?
This is from the top floor, Consuela.
A pause.
I understand.
Chang grimaced as he listened to the recording of Akbar trying to convince the flyers that he had asked for injections to help calm them. Both began scuffling and shouting, and Chang could tell they were held down and given the shots, and now they were gone. Anyone who had seen either of them land in New Babylon and make their way from the hangar to the palace and to Akbar's office would never admit it or mention it. They had been shot down by the enemy, and that was that. Chang checked on the planes again. Already their serial numbers had been changed, and the original numbers were marked as lost in action. Somehow the total number of operative GC fighter bombers in New Babylon didn't change. The story that had scrolled across Chang's screen would broadcast around the world that night. No doubt Carpathia himself would express abject personal sorrow over the losses. Chang checked the records in Greece and found that Nelson Stefanich had forwarded location coordinates to Howie Johnson's team.
It was a couple of hours yet till nightfall when Mac planned to pay the visit. Chang had time to confirm Mac's instructions to the crew at the Ptolemais airport to refuel the Rooster Tail and entered into the computer that Senior Commander Johnson had been cleared at the highest levels to fly it to New Babylon. That done, Chang found Stefanich's cell phone number and called it in to Mac.
"Got everything else you need?" Chang said.
"Well, I'd still like to know the disposition of the Stavros kid."
"Nothing on that here, sir. Do you hold out any hope?"
"Always, Chang, but that's just me."
"Ask Stefanich."
"Oh, I will. Hey, Chang."
"Sir?"
"Who's better than you?"
"Thank you, sir."
Finally, Chang was able to check his other recordings from throughout the day. He located the one emanating from Carpathia's office and backed up to several minutes before Nikolai, his secretary, Crystal, Leon Fortunato, Suhail Akbar, and Viv Ivan sat watching the feed from the cockpit of the initial fighter bomber. Suhail had just told the potentate he had arranged for him to watch live, and Carpathia had expressed excited anticipation. Chang sped through several minutes of setup and of Nikolai welcoming the various ones into the room. Then, pay dirt. Akbar informed Carpathia that the fighter bombers were set for takeoff from Amman and that he could bring that up on the monitor, if you wish.
"If I wish, please."
"Palace to Amman command," Suhail said.
"Amman, go ahead, Palace.
Initiate visual coverage of takeoff."
"Roger that."
Several seconds of silence, then Carpathia.
"Suhail, these are fighter bombers?
Is it an optical illusion?
They look huge."
"Oh, they are, Eminence. They have been in service only a few weeks. Notice how high they sit off the ground. The gear is the tallest of any fighter ever.
It has to be to allow room for the payload."
"That is the bomb underneath?"
"Yes, sir."
"Talk about huge. It looks massive."
"Way too big to be carried internally, sir. It's 4.5 feet in diameter and 11 feet long. The thing weighs 15,000 pounds.
"You do not say."
"Oh, yes, sir. It's carried on what we call an underbelly centerline station."
"And what is it, Suhail? What are we serving the enemy today?"
"The Americans used to call these Big Blue 82s. They are concussion bombs. 80% of their weight is made up of a gel consisting of polystyrene, ammonium nitrate, and powdered aluminum."
"Is it as powerful as it is large?"
"Excellency," Suhail said, "nothing but a nuclear weapon would be more so. These are designed to detonate just a few feet off the ground and generate 1,000 pounds of pressure per square inch. It should kill everything, even the little creatures below the ground, in an area as large as 2,000 acres. The mushroom cloud alone will rise more than a mile, and we're dropping 2.
"Plus a missile?"
"Yes, sir."
"Fire?"
"Oh, your highness, that's the best part. Each concussion bomb creates a fireball 6,000 feet in diameter."
Chang recoiled at a loud hiss, and he imagined a nearly overcome Carpathia inhaling deeply through his nose and exhaling through clenched teeth. Later, when the pilots let loose their payloads, Nikolai said,
"Suhail, how quickly can we get this on television?"
"I'm sure it's just a matter of a few switches, Excel."
Do it now!"
Someone left the room. The recording was interrupted only with occasional outbursts from Carpathia.
"Ah, look! Oh, perfect! On target! Both of them, the best revenge is success."
"Absolutely."
"And victory."
"Yes, sir."
"Total and complete," Nikolai said.
Several grunted. A loud sigh ended in a hum. It reminded Chang of a lion he had seen at the zoo in Beijing. It had just gorged itself on several pounds of raw beef, roared, yawned, and stretched, settled its wide chin on its paws, and sighed like that, followed by a low rumbling from deep inside. For several minutes they watched, and occasionally someone congratulated Nikolai. "Finally, your lordship." That was Viv Ivans. Carpathia did not respond, making Chang wonder if she was still in his doghouse. To all the other compliments, he merely said, "Thank you. Thank you." The suggestion from the primary pilot to abort the missile launch was immediately rejected by Suhail. "Yes," Nikolai said in the background. "Very good, Director Akbar. The final dart." When the pilot sounded insubordinate, Suhail immediately countered. Then silence, finally broken by Carpathia. "Was I hearing things, or did he dare cross you?" "He came right to the edge, Excellency."
"Reprimand him," Leon squawked.
"I do not believe he meant for me to hear it. He is watching in person what we are seeing on a screen. Of course it sounds like overkill to him."
"But still,"
Leon said. Someone shushed him. When the missile hit and the pilot began his halting, disbelieving commentary, Chang heard a chair roll back as if someone had stood suddenly.
"What?"
That was Nikolai.
"Impossible!"
Fortunato.
"Cut the feed,"
Carpathia said, and Akbar repeated it, loud. Footsteps away from the table and, Chang assumed, toward the monitor, the door opening, the sounds of people leaving, evidently everyone but Nikolai and Suhail.
"Two of our largest incendiary bombs?" Carpathia whispered. "You said one was more than enough." "It should have been. We saw the flames, watched them burn for how long?"
"Long enough."
Several minutes of relative silence, during which Chang believed he heard Carpathia panting. And when the potentate finally spoke, he sounded desperate and short of breath.
"Listen to me, Suhail."
"Yes, sir."
"Are you listening?"
"I am, sir."
"Deal with those pilots. They missed. They failed. Their eyes deceived them. Do not allow this victory to go to the Judahites. Do not!"
"I hear you, sir."
"Then contact the other 9 regional potentates personally on my behalf. Tell them the Judahites have raised their arms against us and have dealt a severe blow. We shall retaliate. I told them this only recently."
"You did, sir."
"But the time is now. The budget is limitless. I will sanction, condone, support, and reward the death of any Jew anywhere in the world. I want this done as a top priority by any means. Imprison them, torture them, humiliate them, shame them, blaspheme their god. Plunder everything they own. Nothing is more important to the potentate. Do you understand?"
"I do."
"Go quickly, do it now."
"Yes, sir."
"And Suhail?"
"Sir,
send Reverend Fortunato in."
In seconds, Leon came bustling.
"Oh, Highness, I don't know what to say. I can't understand it. What went—"
"My dear, most high Reverend Fortunato, kiss my hand."
"How may I serve you, potentate? I kneel before you."
"Be still and hear me.
Are you still my most trusted devotee?"
"Oh, yes, supreme—"
"Shh! My reverend father of Carpathianism?"
"I am, sincerely."
"Leon, do you love me?"
"You know I do."
"Do you cherish me? With all my—"
"Do you worship me?"
"Oh, my beloved—"
"Stand up, Leon, and hear me. My enemies mock me. They perform miracles. They poison my people, call sores down on them from heaven, turn the seas into blood, and now they survive bombs and fire. But I too have power. You know this. It is available to you, Leon. I have seen you use it. I have seen you call down lightning that slays those who would oppose me. Leon, I want to fight fire with fire. I want Jesus's. Do you hear me?"
"Sir?"
"I want messiahs."
"Messiahs?"
"I want saviors in my name."
"Tell me more, Excellency."
"Find them, thousands of them. Train them, raise them up, imbue them with the power with which I have blessed you.
I want them healing the sick, turning water to blood and blood to water. I want them performing miracles in my name, drawing the undecided, yea, even the enemy away from his God and to me. I will do it, Excellency. Will you? I will if you will empower me. Kneel before me again, Leon. Lay your hands on me, Risen One. I confer upon you all the power vested in me from above and below the earth. I give you power to do great and mighty and wonderful and terrifying things, acts so splendiferous and phantasmagorical that no man can see them and not be persuaded that I am his God. Leon sobbed. Thank you, Lord. Thank you, Excellency. Go, Leon, Carpathia said. Go quickly and do it now. Chapter 5 George felt pretty well, considering. How long had it been since they had put him in the back seat of the jeep? He was opposite the driver's side, with Elena in front of him, Plato beside him. The leader slid in behind the wheel and told Plato to blindfold George again. George liked the fact that he was again sitting on his hands, giving him an excuse to bounce and tumble into Plato. If he timed it right, maybe he could even bang heads with him. The leader backed up the jeep and stopped, idling. "Where is he?" he asked Testy. "There, by the road." "What is he doing there?" A loud sigh. "Socrates! Come here!" George heard the hobbling footsteps. "Are you finished with the car?" "Hidden, Aristotle. Give me the keys." "Why? What if I need it? That will ruin everything. Give them to me!" George heard the jangling as Aristotle took the car keys. "Think, man," he said. "This way, no matter what happens, you have no keys to surrender. And stay away from the road. You have no reason to be outside. Just wait in there." Aristotle lowered his voice as if thinking a blind Sebastian couldn't hear him. "Remember, the closer you come to the edge, the more believable you are." "You know I can do it." "You know I do. You can still produce tears at will. Take it right to the brink. It has to look like you tried everything before you crumbled. Now, I am sorry you are hurt, but this is just as important as what we are doing." Chloe could see why her father so admired Mac. He was earthy and plain, but he was also meticulous. He had spread the pages of the local GC's Sebastian file on the dashboard of his borrowed car. In the woods north of Ptolemais, with the other vehicle, the hot-wired jeep hidden deeper in the underbrush, they studied the record. Chloe leaned in from the passenger's side. Hannah peeked over their shoulders from the back seat. All three wore GC-issue camouflage, their faces streaked with grease.
"They were thinking when they got this gal that looks like the Stavros girl."
"Georgiana," Hannah said.
"Right. This one's real name is Elena, last initial A. The only one whose actual name is given. Guess they don't feel any need to protect her. Then a couple of no-account locals, both of which it looks like tried to get out of peacekeeping duty, but wound up on this vigilante squad. Oh, get a load of these monikers."
"One of them's the leader, Mac," Hannah said, pointing.
Mac shook his head.
"Aristotle. Other one's Socrates. Real creative. Given this, shouldn't Elena be Helen? Of Troy? Get it? And the big guy, the one that's supposed to pass for George, Plato? Oh, for the love of all things sacred. Well, whatever you gotta do to keep track of each other, he's French. Brought in just for this. Sebastian would be insulted. This guy's heavy, but he's under 6'2". He's no George."
Mac kept glancing at his watch, and as night fell, they kept reading, memorizing. They finally had to resort to the dome light and three tiny flashlights.
"The original plan wasn't half bad," Chloe said. "Only somebody didn't cooperate."
"I don't know the boy or the other old guy, the driver," Mac said. "But from what I know of Miklos, my money's on him. Anyway, somebody smelled a rat. They were supposed to pick up the girl 8 kilometers north of the airport, then have Plato, pretending to be Sebastian, show up just down the road."
But Sebastian was expecting to hook up with them closer to the airport, Hannah said.
They must have wanted to be sure the deal was done before he came looking, Max said. They're pretty proud of this change of plans. Looks like they originally wanted to take them all in, including George, and then threaten to kill the others if George wouldn't talk. Then, even if he did, they were going to execute him together if they wouldn't take the mark.
Chloe had turned the page slightly. Did we know this? She said.
What's that? Max said.
The shootings, all three of them, were done by the girl.
Chloe had that tingling sensation inside as the 0 hour drew near. Mac had studied the coordinates and determined they were about 40 minutes from where George was being held. At 21:30 hours, he called Stefanich on his private cell phone with the number provided by Chang. Early in the afternoon in Chicago, Buck and Enoch called their people together. Quick update, Buck said. Chang has a trace on Ming, and it appears she's probably on her way to San Diego, then on to China. Problem is, he doesn't know where their parents are, so she couldn't either, as far as we know.
How'd she get to San Diego? Albie said.
The long way. Guess she got a ride with some private pilot out of Long Grove to South Carolina, then was able to...
Whoa, Leah said. Hold on. Long Grove?
Yeah, then she...
Buck! Was the pilot this Whalum guy?
I don't know. The point is she...
The point is, if it is him, he's the guy who wants to ship housing modules to Petra.
That stopped Buck.
I don't get it. She might be going to Petra.
She'll never make it. Security's too tight.
Tell me about it.
Maybe she just caught a ride with a guy who's going on to Petra, but she isn't.
That's worth praying about, Leah said.
That's why we're here.
So Ming used a co-op contact. Can we move on here, Leah?
Sure, but we haven't even checked him out yet. Don't know if he's legit. And here I thought when Ming was reading through all these records that she was just helping out.
Buck cocked his head at Leah. Weren't you the one who said Ming was an adult and free to do what she wants?
Mac was surprised when the phone rang 4 times. GC policy was that command officers always be available to the brass.
This is Nelson Stefanich, he heard finally, and the only reason I'm answering a call from a hidden number is because of a current operation, so state your business.
Well, Nelly digging a ditch, Stefanich, how in the world are you?
Who?
Sorry I missed you today. Howie Johnson here.
Yes, sir, Commander. Have we met?
Nah, but I hear such good things about you, I feel like I know you. Know what I mean?
Thank you, sir.
Appreciate the info you gave my aide today.
No problem.
We're about ready to roll here, Nels, and I just wanted to give you a heads up so you can let your guy Aristotle know we're on our way. I'm assuming your phone's secure.
Of course, Commander.
Good, good. Now, I don't want them getting spooked. They should be expecting us and not start shooting the minute they hear us. We want to protect them, too, so we won't be driving right to their door. We'll approach on foot, and when we're within range, I'll give out 2 loud whistles. They should respond with 1, and we'll know it's safe to come on ahead.
Got it. You whistle 2, they whistle 1.
And they understand that as soon as I'm on the scene, I am the ranking officer.
Oh, yes, sir. Absolutely.
Pretty creative, the code names, by the way.
Thank you.
Listen, we keep forgetting to ask about the original target, a G. Stavros, female, escapee from the pen there. What's the dispo on her?
Well, you know she was the source of much of what we know about the Judite underground here, sir.
So she's a valuable commodity.
Yes, she was.
Past tense?
Affirmative. Deceased.
That's so.
Yes, sir. Still refused the mark, even after providing a lot of information.
Guillotine?
Actually, no, sir.
You understand the blade is protocol, don't you, Commander Stefanich?
Under normal circumstances, yes, sir.
And the difference here was?
She began giving us false information.
Such as?
Well, we never did get a straight answer on the location of the underground now. She was one of them caught in the raids of their original meeting places, so we know when she came back she had to know at least 1 of the new locations.
Makes sense. Wouldn't give it up, eh?
No, sir. In fact, after the third wild goose chase, that was when she was...
executed?
Yes, sir.
How?
Firing squad.
It took a squad to shoot a teenage girl?
Squad is a euphemism we use, sir.
I'm listening.
Anyone past a certain level is authorized to attack enemy personnel with extreme prejudice.
Shoot 'em dead?
Exactly.
And then whoever did it shares the credit with the rest of the team? The squad?
Right.
You shot her, didn't you, Commander?
Yes, sir, I did.
Well, that showed remarkable, almost indescribable fortitude there, Nelson.
Thank you, sir.
I know you did it in behalf of and with the deep gratitude of the global community, starting right at the top.
Thank you very much.
Don't thank me, Commander Stefanich. The fact is that I wish I could personally reward you for that act.
Merely doing my duty, sir.
Pay you back, as it were, for that service to the cause.
Well, I don't know what to say. That would be just...
All right, Nally, time's a-wastin' here. You inform the Greek philosophers and their lady friend that we'll drop by to see him in a bit here.
Will do. Sir?
I'm here, Max said.
We're hoping you can help, of course, but you need to know we're pretty happy with this operation.
Oh, I can see how you would be.
Well, I may have read something into it, but I got the impression from your aide that you might want to express some impatience with the crew because the prisoner hasn't yet been forthcoming. We're planning to honor them for what they've accomplished.
I hear you, Commander. I wouldn't worry about that. I think it's fair to say that we want to respond proactively to their actions as well.
We'll want to give thanks also, of course, for the miracle at Petra today, Buck said, that two experienced pilots could miss with such huge bombs at such close range. Well, praise the Lord. The others laughed.
Yes, Albie said, and for the fact that somehow all the people caught fire anyway. Well, talk about amazing.
But seriously, Buck said, God is acting in ways beyond description, and we never want to take for granted his power and sovereignty, his care for us, his protection of our loved ones. And with that, several kneeling at the safe house began spontaneously to pray and praise the Lord. Enoch led in prayer for the safety of our new friends, our brothers and sisters, Mac, Chloe, and Hannah, as they undertake a dangerous mission. Protect them, go before them, send angels to guard them, and may they bring our brother from California out safely so we can all thank him and rejoice with them. Chloe was grateful when Mac turned in his seat and held out an open palm to her and to Hannah. They both grabbed hold, and he prayed. It wasn't long and it wasn't eloquent, but it was Mac, and he sounded as if he knew who he was talking to, and that settled Chloe. A little. Temporarily. When Mac pulled to within what he said should be a half mile from their destination, Chloe was glad for the chance to get out of the vehicle. The ground was uneven, but not bad, and she knew a short hike would be good for her nerves. They all turned off their cell phones and carried them in their left rear pockets. Tiny walkie-talkies were set to a unique frequency, set on low and carried in the right rear pockets. Chloe took the safety off the ancient Luger on her right hip, and Hannah unsnapped the leather strap over the grip of her Glock. The three of them strapped loaded Uzis on their right shoulders so they hung near their rib cages. Mac tossed Chloe the DEW from the trunk, and she angled it over her left shoulder. He handed Hannah a small, heavy canvas bag with extra clips for the Uzi and several rounds for the 50-caliber rifle, which Mac wrestled vertical, the feet of the bipod pointing away from him. He supported the 4-foot-long, 35-pound weapon by cradling the butt in his right palm and wrapping his left hand around the stock.
"Good thing I'm in reasonable shape for one of my vintage," he said. "Pushing 60 and I can still outrun either one of you if the course is long enough."
"Not carrying that thing," Hannah said, and Chloe noticed the quaver in her voice. It was comforting to know she was not the only one scared to death.
"Don't bet on it,"
Mac said, deftly reaching up with his left foot and slamming the trunk.
He held out his compass toward Hannah's flashlight and started off.
"Follow me, ladies."
Mac's boots crunched a steady pace, and Chloe soon found herself perspiring and breathing heavily. But she felt good, and Hannah appeared able to keep up, too. The work did not, however, take Chloe's mind off the danger. The bluffs had worked well so far, maybe too well. If this were going to be easy, they wouldn't be so heavily armed. Chang tracked Ming to San Diego and noticed she would not be flying out of there until early evening, West Coast time. He called her cell phone.
"Hello, Chang," she said.
"Where are you?"
"Is this a test? Do you think I'm going to try to convince you I'm at the safe house in Chicago?"
"You have to know I've talked to them."
"Of course, and I can tell from the benefits to my pilots that it didn't take you long to track me."
"But where are you specifically, Ming, and what are you doing?" She sighed.
"I am in a tiny charter terminal south of San Diego. My papers and my look are working perfectly. No one asks to see my mark because I am in uniform, and when the pilots see my believer's mark, they become very protective."
"You don't tell them who you are, do you?"
"Yes, Chang. I am a fool. No, of course not. Why burden them with something that could bring them trouble? They cannot be held responsible for what they do not know. This is the perfect cover. They are helping the global community by transporting an employee. They know secretly I'm a believer, but they don't know I'm a woman, or former GC, or AWOL. Ming, you know father and mother are not at home."
"I assumed."
"Then how will you find them?" "I will ask around in my official capacity. Maybe I will arrest them."
"You have not thought this through."
"I have, Chang, more than you know. They have to contact you somehow before I get there. You can tell them I am coming and we can set a meeting place."
"Why didn't we try to arrange this before you left?"
"Because you would have refused. You think you know so much. Well, you do. But you don't know everything, or you would know that I cannot sit in a safe house while my parents flee for their lives. Do we know they are true believers, or have we just talked them out of taking the mark of loyalty? I must know. I must get them together with believers. I know I cannot save their lives, or even my own, but I have to do something."
Chang was moved. So she had thought it through. Maybe not every detail, maybe not strategy. But who could?
"You must let me know where you are as soon as you get there," he said. "You love me, don't you, Chang?"
"Of course."
"We never tell each other. We never have."
"I know," he said. "But we know we do."
"You cannot say it."
"Yes, I can," he said. "But even thinking about it makes me emotional, and I must not allow that. Not right now."
"You emotional? Impossible."
"Don't say that, Ming. If you say that, you don't know me."
"I'm sorry, Chang. I was teasing you."
"Well, the truth is, sister, I do love you." Chang immediately teared up, and he felt a lump in his throat.
"I love you with all my heart, and I worry about you and pray for you." "Thank you, Chang."
"Don't now. It's all right. I didn't want to make you uncomfortable. And anyway, I know."
"I know. Okay? I love you too and pray for you often. You do need to stay rational and practical, so don't worry about me."
"How can I not?"
"Because I go with God. He will protect me. And if he decides my time is up, it won't be that long before I see you again anyway."
"Don't say that."
"Come, come, Chang. It's all right. You know it's true. There are no guarantees anymore, except we know where we are going. I will call you from China. I will be hoping for good news about father and mother."
After about 10 minutes walking, Chloe moved aside and let Hannah fall in behind Mac. Hannah gave her a long look in the low light as if to ask if she were all right.
"It's okay," Chloe said. "I'll be right behind you."
She'd had a little trouble staying with Mac, but she decided if she was behind Hannah, she'd be more motivated. If Hannah could stay with Mac, she could, too. And she was right.
Chloe didn't want to give either of them the idea she was petering out. In fact, she didn't believe she was. They were on a gravel road now, and she had a rhythm going, and her breathing was steady and deep. She was sweating through her clothes, but Mac and Hannah had to be doing the same. Finally, Mac held up his right hand briefly before having to get it under the .50 caliber again. He slowed and stopped, moving to the side of the road and turning to face the women.
"Everybody okay?"
They both nodded.
"Anybody need a breather?"
Though panting, both shook their heads.
"Almost there,"
he said, and they started uphill. Just over a rise, Mac knelt and lay the .50 caliber on the ground. He made a V with his fingers under his eyes, then pointed through a clearing to a small wood shack. A faint light shone through the sliver between a shade and one window in the front. He took the directed energy weapon from Hannah and leaned it against a tree. Mac motioned that they should follow him around back. Chloe was surprised how wide he made the arc, staying in the shadows and somehow walking so quietly she could barely hear his boots on the soil. When her Uzi brushed the handle of the Luger, it made a muted scraping sound and she held her breath. Mac stopped and half turned. Chloe had to resist the urge to raise her hand in acknowledgement and apology. She set herself again, and they crept around the back, where trees blotted any light from the stars, and the shack was totally dark. Mac squatted about 40 feet behind the place.
"I don't like it," he whispered. "Only one vehicle, and that looks like mine, so it's likely the one Sebastian got from the GC pool at the airport. And does that place look like it's got 5 people in it? I mean, I know they're hiding out, but..." "You lost me already," Hannah said between gulps of air. "I don't see any vehicles."
Mac put a hand on her shoulder and turned her toward the side of the shack, where a small white car sat mostly hidden in underbrush. Hannah nodded. Chloe hadn't seen it either.
"Maybe your eyes aren't adjusted to the light yet," Mac said, as if he meant it.
Chloe nearly laughed aloud. They had all been traipsing around in the dark. Mac slipped the Uzi off his shoulder and lay it on the ground. He pulled what looked like a utility tool from a vest pocket.
"I know this is gonna sound like a cowboy movie," he said, "but cover me."
Before Chloe could ask where he was going, he moved quickly to the car and went to work on the trunk lock. Every time he made a sound loud enough for the women to hear, he stopped dead and remained motionless a few seconds. Eventually came the thump of the lock giving way and the trunk lid sprung free. Mac kept a hand atop it so it wouldn't fly open. He snaked his other hand in as far as he could, then finally had to let the lid rise another half inch or so. That triggered the trunk light, so he lowered the lid again. He set the tool on the back bumper, reached in, and held the lid down with his left hand, feeling around inside with his right. Once he found what he was looking for, he quickly pulled his hand out, grabbed the tool, reached back in, let the trunk up enough to give himself room to maneuver, and, as the light came on, ground the tool into the bulb, breaking it and dousing the light. Now he let the lid open all the way, silently, and felt around inside the trunk. From where she waited, it looked to Chloe as if the whole top half of his body was inside. Suddenly he stopped and backed out, quietly shutting the trunk and hurrying back.
"Just as I thought," he said. "Check it out." "A 12-gauge, Hannah said. "Learned to use one when I was a kid."
"These GIs love their shotguns," Mac said. "Leaves a DW and a 50 in the plane, brings his double barrel on the job. And brilliant as this hostage team is supposed to be, they don't even search his car."
"We going in?" Hannah said. "Yeah, but I still don't like it. Half of them take off when they found out we were coming, or what?"
He clearly wasn't expecting an answer. Mac handed the shotgun to Hannah.
"Makes a lot of racket when you cock it, so do it when I whistle."
He picked up the Uzi, and they followed him back around to the front and the darkest area they could find, about 20 feet left of the door. Mac nodded to Hannah and whispered,
"On three."
He counted with his fingers and whistled shrilly twice while Hannah expertly and noisily cocked the shotgun. From inside the shack came hurried movement, heavy steps, one louder than the other, like someone limping.
The door squeaked open a couple of inches, and someone whistled, or tried to. It was mostly air. Then came the second try.
All right, Max shouted, so loud, Chloe jumped. You know who it is, so show yourself and let us in.
The door opened in and struck the man or his weapon as he tried to get out of the way.
Right this way, he said with a heavy accent.
Mac marched straight toward the door, and Chloe noticed he had a finger on the Uzi trigger.
Senior Commander Howie Johnson coming through with Officers Irene and Jenna. Stand aside, Peacekeeper.
The man, clearly favoring one leg, hopped back against the wall, warily eyeing them and nodding a greeting.
So which one are you? Mac said. Hercules? Constantinople? Who?
Socrates, sir.
Well, sure you are. All right, where is everybody, particularly my prisoner?
Not here, sir.
Mac looked as if he were about to explode. He tilted his head back till his chin pointed at the ceiling.
Not here, sir, he mimicked.
He brought his eyes down to Socrates.
That's all I get? Where are they?
They told me to tell you to read the fine print.
That took a second to register with Chloe, and from Mac's look, with him, too. Mac dramatically moved past Socrates, making him back up again. He strode to the front door and kicked it shut so hard the window rattled and an echo came back from the trees. Mac turned on the man.
The fine print in what? You think I brought the Sebastian file with me into the woods?
I am only telling you what they...
Why don't you just tell me what the fine print says?
They gave me this duty because I slowed them down. I was attacked by the prisoner and he injured me with a kick to the...
I asked you about the fine print, man. What did I miss? What's the message?
That they have the right to move the prisoner at any time without informing the GC until...
Where are they, Peacekeeper? Where did they go?
They do not have to inform their superiors until they have reached their desk.
Do you know where they are?
They thought they heard something long before it should have been you, so...
You understand English, Socrates. I know you do. Do you know where they are?
I believe the reason they didn't tell me was because...
You want me to believe they left you here alone to greet me and didn't tell you where they'd be?
Because if I didn't know, I couldn't tell the wrong person.
I hope you're lying.
Sir?
I hope you're lying because then you can change your mind about telling me before you die.
Commander, I do not know.
Officer Jenna, show Socrates what a 12-gauge does to the front door.
Chloe wondered if Mac was serious. Apparently, Hannah did not. She lifted the shotgun toward the door with one hand, and as soon as the barrel was parallel to the floor, fired. It was as if a bomb had gone off. Chloe was deafened, but nothing was wrong with her eyes. A gaping hole appeared in the door, and the entire thing blew off its hinges and landed several feet from the shack.
The next one goes in your face, Socrates.
But, sir, he cried, I...
Then get on your squawk box and tell your people I want to know where my prisoner is, and I want to know now.
But they...
Kill him, Jenna.
Hannah raised the shotgun as quickly and forthrightly as she had before, and Socrates immediately tumbled to the floor, tears streaming.
Wait, wait!
He dug a walkie-talkie from his pocket, dropping his weapon in the process.
Socrates to Plato, come in, come in. Hello? Plato? I know you can hear me. Please, I need you.
Mac shook his head as if he had no choice.
Jenna? No, please, wait. Elena! Elena, are you there? Come in now, please. I am not joking. Answer me. Aristotle! Aristotle! They will kill me. I know I was not supposed to call you, but I don't care. Please, please come in or I die.
Nothing. His shoulders slumped and he bowed his head, weeping. Mac knelt and put a hand on Socrates' arm.
They're not that far away, are they?
He shook his head, sobbing.
They're close by, aren't they?
He nodded.
You might as well kill me because I die either way.
What are you saying?
They said not to contact them no matter what. Don't tell no matter what.
But they didn't mean not to tell me, did they?
Surely not.
They meant if they were right about the sounds.
If the wrong people showed up.
They're not afraid of GC, are they?
The man shrugged.
I don't know. Maybe I do not understand, but I am a dead man.
Then what difference does it make if you tell me?
Socrates seemed to think about it. He scooted back against the wall and wiped his eyes. He put his walkie-talkie back into his pocket. When he reached for his weapon, Max said, "Just let that lie." Socrates seemed to be trying to catch his breath.
"Were they close enough to hear the shot?" Max said.
"No, maybe."
"How close?"
500 meters east. There is a lean-to garage." Max sat in an ancient stuffed chair.
"Then they heard you calling for them," Socrates nodded. "And they left you to die."
Chapter 6. The celebrating, singing, and dancing at Petra continued into the dark of night. People by the thousands filed into the new pool to submerge themselves and to drink directly from the wide spring in the middle. Manna covered the ground, and Rayford was nearly woozy from its refreshing taste. "Eating directly from God's table," he told Abdullah, "was something I never expected in this lifetime." Abdullah looked overwhelmed with joy. "How can this be, Captain? How dare we be so blessed?" The wording was lost on Rayford, but he knew what his friend meant. A young woman, probably not yet 20, approached.
"Rayford Steele?" she said shyly.
Rayford stood.